Well, thank you, Frank. First of all, my name is Clarence Snyder, and I'm not anonymous. I'm not Clarence S., as you see in there. You spell my name S-N-Y-D-E-R, and you are privileged to tell anybody in the world that I belong to AA. So much for that. Before I do anything else, I want to introduce my wife, Grace. We refer to her as Amazing Grace. She's also a rummy. She has 15 years. But she, you know, there are two types of rummies. There are periodics and there are chronics. She is a periodic. And these periodics are the people who give us a bad name. I am a chronic. I stay drunk all the time, so people know what to expect of me. I'm a steady Eddie. So that was my experience. So much for that. Tonight I would like to talk about miracles. Because I think every person sitting here arrived here by direction of a miracle. I'll tell you something about the way I arrived here. I promise you I will not give you a drunkalog. You can hear plenty of those without sending a fellow 3,000 miles to come up and talk to him about them. So, but here's, I'm a kind of a freak as far as this fellowship is concerned. I came to a fellowship that did not yet exist. Now that, you have to be a real rummy to do that. Or a spook. When I arrived here, there was no such thing as Alcoholics Anonymous. All of this stuff you read about AA starting in 1934 or 35, that's a lot of hogwash. There was no such thing. When I arrived here in February 1938, my sponsor, Dr. Bob, put me in Akron City Hospital, and a number of rummies out of the Oxford movement came to visit me and give me the stories of their lives and tell me what happened to them through booze. Now this was in 1938, and things were entirely different in that time frame. A lot of people sitting here tonight know nothing about those days before your time, but some of the people with gray hair or no hair can remember the 30s and what a desperate time it was. However, let me say this, how I arrived here. I was married to a gal who is a member of a very clannish family. This family invented togetherness. They were always together in my house. At any given time, you would find two, three, or four of them there. And they used to have family conferences in my house to which I was never invited. The simple reason, I was generally the subject under discussion. And the discussions ran along the line of whether they were going to throw me out of my own house again or let me back in. I was in and out of that place like a yo-yo. So I had been between jobs for a couple of years. I've always had an aversion to hard work, but this wasn't the reason I was out of the job at this particular time. I had drank myself out of any suitable employment of any kind, and I was not acceptable. But this family had great concern about my getting something to do. So they had one of these conferences to end all conferences finally. And they were going to give me one last chance to stay with that august body. And this, the provision was that I was to go to work for my wife's brother. He owned a tractor trailer outfit and he hauled merchandise between Cleveland and New York and back. And I was to go to work for him and learn to drive this truck and be his helper. And this would take care of two situations. It would give me gainful employment, And he could also ride herd on me and see that I didn't get drunk. Good thinking. These people were not alcoholics, they were civilians, they were thinkers. A big difference between alcoholics and civilians is just simply this. Civilians think, alcoholics emote. We never do anything by thinking or common sense. We never do anything until we feel a certain way. We feel badly enough, we'll accept this program. If we don't, all the king's horses aren't going to do anything about getting us straightened out. Well, anyway, their thinking got really messed up here. The idea of me going to work on a truck, I had never been on a truck in my life. That was one anti-situation in my mind. The next thing was that it smacked of hard work. And I have always been against hard work. And I've never gotten over that proposition either. But anyway, in order to stay with that crew and be in my own home, I had to go along with this deal. So away we start one night. I had a dollar and some change secreted upon my person that he did not know anything about. Naturally, all alcoholics have an ace in the hole. We always have to have that. I had enough to get a start someplace. So away we go. I hadn't had a drink that day, and we rode all night long, and I'm scared to death. I'm up there in the back of that tractor there, and I look out that little window and see that 20 tons of stuff following me, and we're going hell-bent for election down the road. Winter's just setting in. Somehow or other, everything happens to me in the wintertime. I don't know why this is, but it always does. I was born at a very early age in the wintertime also. And everything seems to happen. And I was up in that coop. This was a sleeper cab. If any sleeping was to be done, my brother-in-law was going to sleep on a seat and I'd sleep in that little nest up there. So that was my domicile. Well, I'm scared and I'm frightened, I'm cold and I'm shaken and I need a drink. There's no way I could get it. And he drove all night, and the next morning he got over New York State, and he had to have his breakfast. I couldn't handle breakfast, but he handled it all right. And we started up again, and away we went all day long, this guy's driving this thing. And there's no idea at all that he's going to teach me anything. I'm just riding there, see? Well, anyway, we finally got the following evening. I'm about spent by now. Being an everyday drinker, being 2 days without a drink. And finally he conked out and he had to take a rest. And he pulled the rig over to a curb and he said, I'm going to take a nap here for about 2 or 3 hours. Fine, I said. This is my first chance to get away from that dodo. And I said, this is the capital of New York. I always wanted to see the Capitol buildings. And away I went. Well, you know, some odd things that we remember. A lot of things that happened in my drinking career I have no recollection of. They were either a matter of record or somebody told me about it. But I remember a few things that happened there. I beat it down the street and got into the first watering hole that I could find. And one look in that place and it was too rich for my blood with $1.20. So I turned around and went down a few blocks and I got into a place that was more suitable to a man of my estate. A real dump. So, odd things happen. You know, I think that we have guardian angels watching over us. And I found an angel in that joint. I prefer to call him an angel. I think he was a fairy, but I'll call him an angel. He kept pouring drinks into me as fast as I would drink them, and that was a good... I was having a great time. Finally, things were getting a little bit too chummy there with that newfound friend of mine. And I figured it was about time to make my exit. So I went into the men's room, locked the door, and went out the window and headed back to the truck. I imagine my good angel friend is still waiting for me. But what happened on the way back to the truck, I presume, all those drinks hit me at once. And when I got back to the truck, my dear brother-in-law was sleeping on the seat, and in my effort to get up in my nest, I stepped on his poor boy's face. Well, he came to with a start, and of course church was out. But he carted me into New York. It was a very, very unpleasant trip into New York City. When he got me in there, he threw me out down on the waterfront. He says, "This is the end of the line. This was your last chance. Don't ever come back to Cleveland. You're done." So there I was. I'm in a town of 6 or 7 million people, and I only know one family in that whole New York area, and that's another sister of his. And of course, she was hostile. She was part of the committee. But if she was my only opportunity to put the arm on someone, and she lived in Yonkers with her husband and two little kids. I remembered where she lived because we were there on our honeymoon. As I say, we did everything together in that family. So I make my way out to Yonkers. This is winter time, of course, as I mentioned. I don't even own an overcoat. But I got out there, and I remember she lived up on top of a hill. But I didn't go up on that hill. I went down the hill and got into the Italian section down there. And in those days, all Italians had wine. A lot of them made it, some of them sold it, a lot of them drank it, and some of them shared it with their friends. So I went down there and made friends. By the time I got up to Virginia's house, up on top of that hill, I was a sight to behold, I imagine. I can only remember a couple little incidents of that visit to her home. I was rolling around on the floor with her two little baby girls. They were just kids, 2 or 3 years old, just little things. And they were having a great old time with Uncle Clarence. But Virginia took a dim view of this performance. She didn't like it so well, so she put me in the back of her car and took me back down to New York and threw me out where her brother had thrown me out. And there I was. I was without money, without clothes, without a home, unemployable, broke, sick, drunk. You men, I had it. There I was. What to do? But you know, alcoholics are the greatest people for survival. I was in New York City a long time. I can't tell you how long. I know the calendar went around once because it was winter again. And I got the homing instinct. I wanted to go home. I wasn't welcome, but I still wanted to go home. And I remember one trucker took me as far as Erie, Pennsylvania, and another one took me into the outskirts of Cleveland where I lived. And it was, when I got out to my house, snow was up to my elbows. I lived in a snow belt out there. And I charged up on the porch and tried to get into the house. And I noticed a very peculiar thing about that house. In the middle of winter, and all the screen doors and screens were still up. So I got up there and pounded on the screen door, and Dorothy came out to the screen because she didn't unhook the screen. So she talked to me through this screen door, and I'm using all my wiles to get into this house. But I'm getting no place. It's a total failure. But here's what happened. After I'd been in Yonkers, and Virginia had thrown me out on the waterfront, where her brother had, sometime, short time later, she had the doctor over to her house, and the doctor was a family friend. I don't know if I infected the kids or what, but anyway, I was dirty, I was stunking, I was drunk, and so forth. But she had the doctor over, and they got to talking about drinking, which was a favorite topic in those bootleg days. Everybody talked about drinking. And she, Virginia, was talking to this doctor, and she related to him about this visit of her brother-in-law, me, who used to be such a nice guy, her favorite brother-in-law, what a no-good, dirty, stinking, drunken bum he is now. And this doctor says, "You know, that's odd." He says, "I have a brother-in-law here in New York who is a lush, and he met some strange cult of people down at Calvary House down here, at Dr. Schumacher's church. And since he met this strange cult, he runs around New York trying to fix drunks. He brings the drunks home, and about the best he gets out of them, they smash up his furniture for him and a few things like that. He doesn't have much luck with the drunks, but it's keeping him sober. And he says, furthermore, there's a Dr. Robert Smith in Akron, Ohio, who belongs to this strange cult. And if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can go down and meet this doctor, and the doctor can fix him, because this doctor spends all his time fixing drunks. Of course, I don't know this is going on, naturally. But Virginia wrote Dorothy, my wife, about this doctor in Akron. So here it's quite a long time later that I breeze in to try to get in my house, and she don't let me in. But through the screen door, she told me about this Dr. Robert Smith in Akron and asked me if I'd like to get on and meet him. Well, I have nothing to lose. I can transact my business in Akron as well as I can in Cleveland. So she puts me in her car. These people are always riding me someplace. She puts me in her car and takes me down to the bus depot, gave me Doc Smith's name and address, and she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron and got rid of me. So that's how I met my sponsor. I would like to go into the story about what happened, but I ran out on him the first time I met him because I was scared to death of this man. And it's too long a story to go into tonight because I only have 4 hours up here. Well, he don't believe it. So anyway, I get down to Akron and I met my sponsor and I ran out on him. Well, you know, a funny thing happened. I worked my way back to Cleveland. I didn't work it. I bummed my way back to Cleveland. Let me put it in the proper perspective here. I never worked at anything. So I got back there and I joined some of my pals in one of the bottle gangs that I knew, I was accepted in. And one day, we were all laying around there, and, you know, it makes you feel important to institute something with your peers. So I made the bland announcement that I was going to quit drinking and quit all this foolishness. Now, here's what drove me back to my sponsor. Now, get this. Some flannel mouth Irishman there, he was a head mocho in this gang. He's a tough little guy. And he looks at me and says, you quit drinking, you'll never quit drinking. I says, I am going to quit drinking. He says, you'll never quit drinking. You don't have guts enough to quit drinking. He says, look at you. He says, now remember, he's drunk too. He says, look at you. He says, you know, to quit drinking takes determination, he says. He says, to have determination, he says, you need a chin. He says, look at you, I got a chin like Andy Gump, you're no damn good. I says, I'll show you, I know a doctor in Akron can fix me. He says, nobody can fix you. I says, this doctor can. He says, you show me. I says, I'll show you. Well, I got a hold of someone's telephone. I don't know whose, but somebody got a fine bill because they were all toll calls. And we did not have telephone facilities where we were. So I broke in somewhere on this phone. And Doc told me later, I called him 6 or 8 times. I don't remember that at all, but I remember talking to him once. And he told me to meet him the next morning in Akron City Hospital. And there I went the next morning. I got enough together for bus fare down there. But when I got there, I didn't have any money to get any streetcar fare out to the hospital. If any of you ever been in Akron, Ohio, you know it's called the City of Seven Hills, just like Rome. And all of their hills are up. There are no downhills in Akron. They're all up. And I walked out from that bus depot to that hospital. I don't have an overcoat. It's zero weather in February and a snowstorm going, swirling around. And I walked out there and I got into that hospital. And that's all I remember. I fainted. When I landed in the lobby of that hospital, I passed out. And the next thing I know, I was up in a room, and a bunch of people in white were around me. And for some strange reason, they were giving me a bath. Well, you know, alcoholics must always have ace in the hole. I was a chronic drinker. I was not a periodic. So I never had DTs. I'd seen some of my buddies with them, and in fact, I saw a couple of them die in them. And I always was fearful of having DTs. And I know the antidote, and I know what to look for in DTs. When music starts and there isn't any band around, and there's some circus acts going on, there are no animals around, really, you're in trouble. And the first thing you want to do is get all the booze thrown into your can, and it chases all that nonsense away. So when I woke up in that hospital room and all these people working with me, the first thing I saw on a windowsill was a bottle of rubbing alcohol. But there is my ace in the hole. If anything, if I start hearing music, no band, having a circus parade, no, I can't smell the animals. There's my answer. That gave me the courage. That nurse came in, I can remember this so plainly. A nurse came in with a tray, and on it she had a great big shot of booze and a great big shot of murky, whitish liquid. And she said, "Mr. Snyder," not the first time I've been called Mr. for a long time. I had some other pet names. She says, "We have some medicine for you. That you take this medicine and drink it down and wash it down with this nice whiskey. Here's a rummy for you." I'm looking at that rub over there on the windowsill, and I know there's a bottle of that in every room. I'm sure there would be. And I look at that, and I look at that nice whiskey, but I know what that other crap was. That was formaldehyde. That makes you go to sleep with your eyes open. So I told her, I said, "I'll have you to know, you can take that stuff out of here. I came down here to quit drinking. I'll thank you for taking that stuff away from me." Boy, that's the worst thing I ever did in my life. She took it away. Well, I lay there and suffered the agonies of the damned for about a week. After a couple of days, some men came in to talk to me, rummies. They were all older than I was. 10, 15, 20 years older. I was only 35 then. You don't have to take your shoes off. It was 45 years ago, 35. I'll be 81 years old next month. And so I'm there. Those fellas told me the stories of their life. And an odd thing happened. Every one of them told me the same thing before he left. He says they told me they had the answer to my drinking problem. And on that note, they left. And at the end of it, didn't tell me what the answer was, they went. Well, every afternoon, Doc came in to see me. And Doc, if any of you knew Doc Smith, they all call him Dr. Bob. They never call him Dr. Bob, we call him Doc Smith. How they furnish up these things as years go by. Well, anyway, Doc came in, and he was a 6'4", and he was a rectal surgeon. And Doc would come in and point his finger at me. He had the longest fingers. And he used to poke me with that finger to emphasize things. And he'd come in every day and look at me. And finally, the last day I'm in there, he says to me, "Young fella," he called me young fella. He gave everyone a name, but I being only 35 years old, they didn't have anyone that young. The youngest next to me is about 45. So he called me young fella. So he said, "Young fella," he says, "what do you think of all this by now?" I said, "Doc, I think it's wonderful. All these fellas coming in to see me, they don't know me from a load of hay." And they spend their time talking to me and telling me the story of their life. And I know they're all rummies, but I'm puzzled about one thing.
And he says, and what's that?
Doc was a man of few words. I mean it. He was rough. So I said, well, I said, those men come in and tell me their story, and before they leave, they all tell me they have the answer to my drinking problem. They don't tell me what the answer is. What are you going to do to me now? I'm looking for some kind of an operation. I'm in a hospital. So he threw me a curve, a real curve. He said, we don't know about you, young fella. You're pretty young. And we haven't had any luck with these young guys. They're all screwballs. Well, I wasn't about to argue that point with him, but he says, we don't know if you're ready for this yet. Ready for this. I'd been between jobs for several years. I had no more home than a rabbit. I had no job. I had no clothes. I was sick. I didn't know where I was going when I left the hospital, see? Nothing. And I weighed 130 pounds, if you please. So I wasn't much to look at. So he doesn't know if I'm ready. What do you have to be ready? So I guess I finally convinced him I was ready. Now here's how he introduced me to this fellowship. See, finally I convinced him. I guess he says, okay, young fella, I'll give you the answer to this. So he points that big finger at me. He says, young fellow, he says, do you believe in God? Holy smokes, it's the last thing I expect to hear from a doctor. I listened to that stuff over in the missions when you needed something, you went over to sing, you know. You sing, they give you anything that you need. Don't have to be a good singer, but you have to sing. Don't ever try to eat in those places, though. I swear, I tried it. And I can't stand being around one of those places. Here's what they do, in case you don't know. You have something to look forward to. Just stay drinking. You'll wind up there someday. They get these used donuts that people can't sell, and rolls and buns, and they bring them over there, and they put them in the mission. And when you go in the mission, all you smell is bug juice. They squirt everybody and everything that comes in there with bug juice, see? And those buns and donuts start absorbing this bug juice. And they lay around there for a week or so, and nobody's eating them, so they transfer them to another mission. Oh, I tell you, I can't even eat in the Salvation Army. There's something about it just turns my stomach to think about it. So, anyway, how did I get into that anyway? But I'd go to missions and you needed some clothes, you need some shoes or pants or a coat or whatever, you go. Don't go there to eat. Sometimes you can get a flop in those places too. Well anyway, that was my experience with the missions. So when he talked to me about asking me if I believed in God, his mission thing come back to me right away. You have to hit that sawdust trail when you go to a mission. If you want to get anything, you got to agree. So when he asked me if I believe in God, this shocked me. So the best thing I came up with is this blubber of mine. I said, whoa, what does that have to do with it? I thought that was a pretty smart answer. He said, young fellow, that has everything to do with it. Do you or do you not believe in God? Now I'm getting a little scared. If I don't go along with this turkey, they're not going to fix me. See? So, he's waiting for an answer, so he jumps on me again. All right, he says, young fellow, what do you tell me? Do you believe in God or don't you believe in God? Now I am scared. So the next good thing I come up with is, well, I guess so. He says, there's no guessing about it. You do or you don't. Do you believe in God or don't you believe in God? Boy, this is a way to hand this thing to a new people, to a new person. Remember this when you go out sponsoring someone. Now I am up the tree. I know I'm I'll be out of there without getting fixed if I don't go ahead with it and tell them and admit that I believe in God. So finally I said, broke down, I said, yeah, I believe in God. He said, now that's fine. Now we can get someplace. So where are we going to get? He says, get down out of that bed. I said, for what? He says, get down on that floor and get on your knees. I said, for what? I'm thinking about this doctor business. I says, for what should I get down there? He says, you're going to pray. I says, I don't know anything about praying. He says, I don't suppose you do, but you get down there, I will pray, and you can repeat it after me, and that'll do for this time. So he hauls me out of that nice warm nest on that cold concrete floor in that shorty nightgown on my bare bones. And I remember he put his hand on my head, and I was watching that other one. And he uttered a prayer, and I repeated it after him. I can't tell you exactly what it was. I have a pretty good idea. But I do remember this, that after he concluded his prayer, he shook hands with me, and he says, young fella, you're going to be all right. So that evening, he took me out of that hospital. He took me over to a meeting at T. Henry and Clarissa's home in Akron. They were the leading domos of the Oxford movement in Akron. And I got a couple of real shocks right then when I walked into that home. I remember I just come off of the bum. I'd been on the bum for several years. And I still had no overcoat in the middle of winter. And I had one brown shoe and one black shoe on. I think someone else had a pair like that somewhere. But you get things mixed up in that society, you know. Well, anyway, I go into that house, and T. Henry was a millionaire. He had a patent on something that went into rubber tires in Akron, where all the tires are made, so he wasn't hurting for dough. He got a rake off at every tire built. So he had a beautiful home. And I walk in there in all my sartorial splendor, and holy smokes, I look at that house. There's oriental rugs on the floor. Paintings on the wall, a grand piano over in the corner, a lot of this little bric-a-brac, these figurines, and I took special inventory of those. A piano is too much. I'd steal a red hot stove, but I had it. But anyway, I look at this thing, I feel all out of place here, the room's full of people. And there are more ladies in there than are men. Now, I might add that I had been away from female company and association for quite some time. I just didn't seem to be acceptable, or I wasn't exposed to them, I guess, where I was. So, here I go. I look in there, and all these nice people are all dolled up like people are here. And, they're all having a great old time. They're hugging and kissing and all this kind of business and going and carrying on. And boy, I feel I'm really lost. But some of those ladies came up and they started making a fuss over me, and I guess I attracted them by my mode of dress. Nothing like a well-dressed man. So, I will always be especially grateful to at least three of those ladies. Annie Smith, Doc's wife, Henrietta Cyberling, and Henrietta Dotson. They just were wonderful to me. So they accepted me in there. But I didn't know what was going on, but the next big shock I got, I looked across the room, and here is my wife, Dorothy, sitting over there. And I was completely out of that family for good up to that moment. But apparently Doc had called her and persuaded her to come down to this meeting and to give me another chance at home. And she came, which was a great break for me. And I saw her, I could have fainted when I saw her sitting over there. But you know, I watched the performance in this meeting, and all the stuff going on, I don't know what they were doing, really. And they're all jumping up and down and witnessing, and some of them are crying, and some of them are laughing, and some of them are very emotional, and a lot of stuff going on. Of course, I didn't know, I couldn't swallow it all. I wasn't in the mental capacity, I didn't have it at that time. But I was there. Well, Dorothy took me home that night to Cleveland, and I stayed there for about a year, which was a great break for me. But about a year later, she threw me out again sober. Boy, I'm telling you, you get it coming and going. But at least I had a chance to get a hold of myself. I was there, and get started in this program that we had in the Oxford movement. People think that somebody sat down and just stretched out this program such and such. I hear a lot of funny stories about how this program started. Don't believe any of them. It's not true. Here's what happened. The Oxford movement had a six-step program. All we did in AA when that book was written, and I was in on the writing of that AA book, this book here, we simply took the 12 steps, or the 6 steps of the Oxford movement, and made 12 out of them for alcoholics. Figuring, I suppose, that if alcoholics can screw up 6 steps, they can screw up 12 much easier. And they do. I hear some of the funniest, some of the weirdest things about this program. People are talking about this program. You know, I was talking to some young fellow today. I said, you know, there are 4 ways of doing anything. There's a poor way of doing something. There's a fair way of doing something. There's a good way of doing something. And there's an excellent way of doing something. Alcoholics are a certain type of individual. Everybody can't be an alcoholic. Remember that. I don't care how hard they try, they'll never be an alcoholic. They just ain't made right. You have to be put together in a certain way to be a rummy. I don't think there's over 8 or 10% of the population who can really be alcoholics. There's a lot of heavy drinkers, and they can quit any time they want. But the alcoholic is a different breed of cats. He's an institution all in his own. And he's put together different than civilians and earth people. And the alcoholic, you can tell him, you can put him in a catalog, or put it in a pigeonhole by characteristics. And I'll tell you a few of the characteristics to look for in a rummy. I've never met a rummy in my life, a true rummy, an alcoholic. You know, I didn't know I was an alcoholic till I was sober for some time. We used to always call them rummies. When we started writing this book, it was the first I ever heard of being an alcoholic. I thought I was being promoted. Well, anyway, a true rummy, I've never met one yet who is not a high-strung individual. I've never met one who didn't have a terrific imagination. They should all write books. They're the biggest liars that ever wore shoes. They lie for practice. They lie when they don't have to. They're very sensitive souls. They're always going around looking for someone to hurt their feelings. They do not think. They emote. They never do anything until they feel a certain way. And so these signs, think, that you see plastered around some of these AA meetings, you ought to tear them down. That's an insult to us. If he's a thinker, he's not an alcoholic. He belongs in Al-Anon. We need those people. It's a darn good thing they outnumber us 9 to 1. Well, the alcoholic is a different breed of cats than people. He's different than people. And we have a lot of things in common. I don't care if you're a periodic or if you're a chronic drinker like I was. You still have the same characteristics. Only the chronic like myself don't cause all the trouble that periodics do. Have you ever noticed these monkeys, what they do? A periodic alcoholic gets a good job. He buys a nice house, gets a bank account. He gets married. He has a nice family. Has 2 cars in the garage and a bank account and belongs to a club or two. For no apparent reason, the guy gets drunk and blows the whole thing. Away goes the house, the furniture, the cars, the wife, the family, the job, the whole bit thing. And what does this turkey do? He goes and gets himself another good job. And what kills me, he gets a better one than he had before. Hey, gets a new wife. New house, new family, new bank account, new cars, everything new. And you know what? The next thing you know, bang, that goes. This is why alcoholics have a bad name. This is why people look down their nose at us. They think we're all nuts. Well, we are nuts, and I'll tell you the truth. If you're not nuts, you don't belong here. We are the greatest collection of nuts in the world.
Okay.
Boy, we never heard of a thing like this when I started out. We could tell lies and they wouldn't go on tape. Now you have to be careful what you talk about. Well, you know, when I left Akron that night, after my first meeting, Dorothy took me home. Doc Smith, my sponsor, told me something that I have never forgotten and I have endeavored to do. He said, now you go back to Cleveland and spend the rest of your life fixing rummies as an avocation. Okay? Now remember, most of those people in that Oxford group were not rummies. They were mostly civilians, as I said before. But he said, I should go back to Cleveland. Now remember, there was no group in Cleveland. There wasn't even an Oxford group in Cleveland. We had no book. I had no literature. I had no nothing. Had no fellowship up there. Nobody. And he said, I should go up and fix drunks. Well, in my ignorance and stupidity, I went to work as best I could to fix drunks. So I walked. There was no shortage of rummies, I'll tell you that. The woods were full of them in those Depression days. There were thousands of men just wandering around that had no homes. Lots of people that had been dispossessed and a lot of vacant houses around that rummies used to, a bottle gang would move into a house to keep for shelter. And they'd tear down all the woodwork and so forth and burn it, and all the woodwork's burnt, they'd move in another house. That's the way they existed. Terrific things going on in those days. So I went up to Cleveland alone to fix drunks. So here was my modus operandi. That's a good word. I walk up to a drunk on the street and say, hey, you should quit drinking, you should be like me. That was a great approach. Well, they didn't want to be like me. And I don't mind telling you, I received a lot of resistance, and some of it was physical. But I did this, and I went to all the sources of rummies. I went to the social workers, I went to doctors, I went to police, I went to churches, I went to Kiwanis clubs and Rotary clubs, every place where men got together, and businessmen or people, professional people, and told them, and all the social workers I went to, that I told them if they had any rummies that needed fixing, send them to me, and I'd fix them. I made all these connections. I did this for 7 long months, torturous months. I don't know how I ever did it, till I finally sold my first baby. You know, a lot of things have happened in AA. You read a lot of this garbage that comes down about this being a program of attraction rather than promotion. That is the biggest bunch of hogwash I heard in a long time. Who wants to get attracted to a bunch of drunks anyway? But it is not. It's a sales job. And this is the greatest sales job in the world. And what are we selling? We're selling a person a chance to recover and get well, a chance to become sane, a chance to live this life, and yes, a redemption for the future life. This is what we're selling. What greater thing can we sell? This is not a traction at all. You mentioned some of those things in some of the meetings I go to, I get thrown out. Really, this is a sales job, and we are all salesmen. What does it say in our program? It says at the end that we should carry a message. To other alcoholics, we should carry a message. But we have to get a message to carry. That's it. You know, I talk and to everybody that would sit still or stand still and listen to me for 7 long months before I sold my first baby. And that story is a story in itself, and I shall never forget it. I felt that I would never be a real Indian until I sponsored someone successfully. So I went at this thing with in all my ignorance. I had a lot of time, a lot of energy, and so forth. And I used it. But it took me 7 long months by myself in Cleveland, Ohio, till I sold my first guy. Now, get this story. I'm going to tell you something about this story, give you an idea what sponsorship is. I was out wandering around Cleveland one day, and I got way over on the other end of town, over in a Polish section over there. And I got into a house there that had been deserted and had been taken over by a bunch of guys in there drunk, laying around. And I went in there and preached my sermon, tell them what was what, and about quitting drinking. And none of them were in favor at all. I was getting no place with any of these guys. I went into another room back there, and lying on the floor on his back was a big man. Bill Hess was his name. And I had never seen a guy in that condition. He was paralyzed drunk. Paralyzed drunk. He couldn't move a muscle. He could speak. He understood what I was saying. He could answer me. But he couldn't move. He was laying there like a blob. So I got down on the floor with him and asked him how he'd like to quit drinking. And he's all for it. This was the first guy that ever gave me any indication that he would listen to me. And I had a captive audience. He couldn't move. Well, I'd ask him the next silly question after we get a hold of $50. If he would, I would put him in a hospital and get him straightened around. For $50, we did. In those days, $40 to $50 a week, we could get you sobered up. It wasn't like it today. You go to $8,000 in these 30-day joints, and you come home and get drunk on the way home. It was different. But I could get him in a hospital then for $50. I might as well ask him for $1 million, because he'd be just about as close to having it. He assured me he didn't have a dime. But he told me, my mother has money, and if you tell her that you have found me and are going to fix me, she will spring with the dough. I said, well, where is your mother? Well, she's on a farm out near Ashtabula, Ohio, which is 55 miles east of Cleveland. So you go out and see her, and she will spring for the dough. Because she hasn't heard from me for several years, nor had his family either. So that was all I needed. The first indication that anybody go along with me, I got on the old jalopy, and away I went. 55 miles out there to that farm. And when I got out there, I was afraid to drive back that lane for fear of getting stuck. So I parked the car on the road and started walking back. The house was way back. And all of a sudden, a dreadful thought came to me. This happened to be the first day of hunting season. Ah. I got about halfway down that lane, and I hear these guns going off everywhere. It sounded like the Battle of the Marne. And it occurred to me that these were probably relatives and pals of Bill Hess. And they're probably all drunk. And they're running around with guns, shooting at everything that moves. And I'm moving down this lane. I stopped and I debated whether to go up to that house or forget the whole bloody thing. But I went up to the house. And I pounded on the door. And this little old lady came to the door, a little wizened old lady. Bill Hess was Polish. He'd been an auditor for Sherwin-Williams Paint Company in Cleveland before. And he was of Polish descent. But he forgot to tell me that his mother was Polish and did not speak English. And when I got out to this farmhouse and met this sweet old lady, I only know two words in Polish. I know Yaksimash and Dubshe, and after that I run out of conversation. And you can only run Yaksimash and Dubshe so long, see? And she comes out and wants to know what I want, of course, and I can't communicate with her. And I'm out there to wheedle $50 out of this old gal. So here comes a little kid, probably a grandchild, about 8 years old. And I used this kid for an interpreter, and through this kid, I talked this old lady out of $50. But in those days, the banks were closed, and if any people had money, you'd see little mounds out in the backyard. They put them in tin cans and buried it. Or they were in sugar bowls or stuck under the rug or in a mattress or something. So that old lady went back in the bedroom and cut a lump out of the mattress and brought me 50 of these great big dollar bills. Remember how big they used to be? Some of you folks probably remember them. Man, I felt I was walking this high. I had the 50 rocks to put old Bill in a hospital. And away I went back to Cleveland with the 50 smackers in my pocket. Get back there and Bill's still lying in the same spot. He hasn't moved. So I called Doc and told him I'm bringing a baby down. We call them babies. We don't call them pigeons. They're babies. I told him I'm bringing a baby down. Fine. So I got some of the other jugheads to help me pick this guy up and throw him in the back of the car. And away we went to Akron and put him in a hospital. And that was my first triumph, my first guy. I know now why it took me 7 months to get my first baby. It says something in the steps about carrying a message. It took me 7 months to get a message. That's what happened. I had a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of time, a lot of ignorance and what have you, but no message. I must have had one, because right after that, bing, 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 I got a whole bunch of guys coming in. And then we had an Irish invasion. The Irish invaded. Now I would take these people down to this Oxford group meeting, and the Oxford group was a Protestant evangelical movement. And first guy I got was a Polack. And then I got a couple of people who once upon a time had been in church someplace. Then a bunch of Irish came in. And out of the first dozen men I had going to Akron, seven of them were Catholics. I would say they were pretty rotten Catholics, but they didn't think so. I mean, it's funny how these guys, they sober up, all of a sudden they become good Catholics. They haven't been in church for 4 years. But there they were. So they go to this Oxford group meeting. Now here's how AA started. There was no AA before this, remember that. Here's the way it went. We wrote this book in the fall of 38, and it came out in 39. All right. These fellas, I took them down to Akron to these Oxford group meetings, and they told me that they couldn't attend these meetings because they were Catholics and they were not supposed to go to Protestant evangelical movements. And the church was fussy about that. I know the church has changed a lot over the years, but in those days they were pretty rigid about some things. And that was one of them. So here they all of a sudden became good Catholics overnight. So they couldn't go to the meetings. We had written this book. In the interim, this book was written in the fall of 38, came out in February 39. We had this AA book with 12 steps. We took those 12 steps and made out of the six. We made it out of the six, as I explained. So, what to do? I went down to see my sponsor, tell him what we're up against. He said, well, we're not keeping the Catholics out. I said, no, you're not keeping them out. Do you have any here? He said, no. I said, well, you ought to have some if you're not keeping them out. Well, we're not keeping them out. I said, of course you're not, but the church keeps them out. It's all the same thing. They can't come. He says, well, that's their tough luck. I says, no, Doc. Now, here's my first real problem with my sponsor. I'm telling him how things should be going. I don't know why I waited so long. But anyway, I told him, no, it isn't a tough look. We don't need all this fall-or-all that the Oxford group goes through, reading out of the King James Version of the Bible and having open confession and getting guidance for other people and all that sort of thing. We don't need that. We have a 12-step program and the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. Anyone can live by that. Doesn't make any difference if he's a Catholic or whatever he might be, if he believes in God. He says, you can't do that. I said, well, can't do what? He said, you can't break this up. I said, Doc, I'm not trying to break anything up. I'm trying to open it up so everybody can get in it. He said, you can't do that. I said, well, we're going to do something. He says, like what? I said, I don't know, but we're going to do something. You know, I'm a bull-headed Dutchman. It's a hard head. I get something in that bone up there. It's hard to knock it out. And I learned some things early in my career, and I still stick by them. So I had another Irishman in the hospital at the time. You can read his story in the later editions of the book. It's the man who thought he could drink like a gentleman. That's Al Goldrick. You'll see my name in his story if you read it. I chased that monkey all winter long, drag him out of saloons and take him home, his wife hiding under the bed when he comes home. Oh, he was vicious. He was a patent lawyer, and he was losing his... He's getting kicked out of his law firm at the time, and also about ready to lose his big home. But he's in there all smoked up with formaldehyde. I didn't talk to him. I went out to see his wife. I wanted to start a group in Cleveland, a meeting, and we didn't have any money. We didn't know anything about renting halls anyway. We didn't have any dope. We didn't find a hall. So I went out to talk to her about using their house for a meeting place, and she was delighted with the idea. Of course, old Al's up in there all smoked up with formaldehyde. He don't know what's going on. When he came out of that hospital, he found out his house was a meeting home. Well, anyway, you have to do things like this. You take the bull by the horns and go. So I went down to Akron. Here's how AA started. Now listen to this carefully. And a lot of these fairy tales you hear about AA starting back in 34, 35, whatever, a lot of hogwash. That was Oxford movement in those days. Doc Smith went to Oxford group meetings 2.5 years before he ever met Bill Wilson, but he only got drunk once after he met Bill, so he caught on okay. Well, anyway, I went down to Akron the following Wednesday night to the meeting, and I made this announcement in Akron. This is the last time that the Cleveland contingent will be down here as a group. We are starting our own group in Cleveland, Ohio, and I made the mistake of giving them the address. I shouldn't have done this. 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. I says, and this is not going to be known as an Oxford group. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book. Now, the book had only been around for 3 months at that time. Boy, I'm telling you, here the Oxford group people were so good to us, and they'd open their hearts and their homes to us and everything, and I'm cutting them out. Clarence, you can't do this. But it's already done. You got to come down and talk about it. I said, there's nothing to talk about it. Oh, there was a riot down there. AA starts in riots and grows in riots. Nobody starts a group because we need a group. Somebody gets mad at somebody. This is the way AA started, and this is the way it grows. It's all over the world now, because there's been a lot of fights. A lot of disagreements. Well, if I thought that was a riot down at T. Henry's that night in Akron, I wish you'd have seen what happened next Thursday night at 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. That whole bunch from Akron descended upon us and tried to break up our meeting. And the one guy, this old Bill Jones, is going to whip me, and I'm sure this is all done in pure Christian love. But it was awful. It was awful. But we stood our ground, and that's how AA started. That's the first AA group in the world. Started in May 1939. So there's some history you don't read in all this approved literature. AA, there's always been two philosophies in AA. I might add this because you might think that I'm a little bit, so about the other philosophers. But there was a philosophy in the East over in New York, and there was a philosophy in the Midwest. In the East, they were the Madison Avenue boys. They were the Idea Minute guys. And they professed agnosticism and atheism and all that kind of ism. We over in the Midwest were stupid. They called us the Bible punchers because we used the Bible in our activities, and we laid this program out for what it is. It's not a drunk sober program. It's a life-changing program. We learned that in the Oxford group, and this program is designed to change our lives. Now, a lot of people have never really heard about what this program amounts to. We have, in this program, 12 steps. 12 steps. There's 200 well-chosen words in our 12-step program. Did you ever count them? And if you look these, when you go home tonight, take some time before you go to bed and take out your 12-step program, and you'll find among those 200 words, alcohol is mentioned once. Once. The other 199 words have something to do with changing your life. Did that ever occur to you? It's the truth. It's once. You know, most of the AA meetings you go to, you hear all this palaver all the time about drunk and sober and drunk and sober. This program is designed to get you straight and keep you straight the rest of your life. You know, I don't sponsor people anymore. I don't have the time or the strength. But here's what I do, and Grace does this too. People hear about this fluky guy down in Castleberry, Florida, that has some way of taking a person through the steps in 2 days, and he never drinks anymore, and he has a good life. Now, out of desperation or curiosity or what have you, people call us. Not people where we live. A prophet is without honor in his own hometown. They think we're bums over there. But we go 100 miles away, we're authorities. That's what Jesus got into, too, so I never forget that. Anyway, these people call. Now, these are people who have been around AA for months or years, and they're miserable. Some of them have been drunk, some haven't. But some of them have been sober. I had one guy come down 11 years, he was dry, on white-knuckle sobriety. Every day in his life, he's fighting that booze. He'd get up in the morning, I hope I don't get drunk today. Please, Lord, don't let me get drunk, and all that crap. Hey, he never learned what this program is. Nobody ever explained it to him. Never told him that this program is a life-changing program. They told him that this is a matter of staying sober all the time. And it isn't. If that's all there was to it, you could go to jail the rest of your life and just hope he's sober. But if you want to live and live among human beings, you got to learn to live like human beings. And we have to do something about it. We change our life. Now, how do we change this life? Our program of 12 steps is divided into 4 phases. As I mentioned before, we take a person through these steps in 2 days. I take a person comes to our home, I have to qualify him. Everyone that comes may not be the one that should be fixed. They come to be fixed, there's a qualification, and here's what it is. You come to me for help, and you're going to spend a couple of days with me, here's the first thing. I want to know you're an alcoholic. I'm not interested in good time Charlies. I'm not interested in anything but alcoholics who want to quit drinking and are serious about it. So, I want to find out if you're an alcoholic. So we have a little sharing together. I want you to know you're an alcoholic. I have to know it. You have to admit it. That's first. The sixth thing I ask you, what do you want to do about it?
Well, I want to quit.
Oh, yes, Buster. Lots of people quit. I'll quit for them. They don't like to hear that too well, but I like to ruffle their feathers a little bit. So the third question is this, and here's the one that really does the deal. After I know he's an alcoholic, he knows it, he admits it, and he says he wants to quit. Here's what I ask him, or her. What are you willing to do to quit drinking forever? I don't say a bloody word about 24 hours or 24 years. Forever. I might add, I get some funny answers to that one. There's only one answer that I can accept. And I'll keep at this person till he gives me this answer. He has to tell me he's willing to do anything to quit drinking forever. Now, I did not make that up, kids. That's in the book. You heard it read tonight. So, the little girl read that very well tonight. She says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are now ready to take certain steps. Isn't that what she said? She read that right out of this book. So I didn't make it up. But how many people ever listen to that? How many people pay a bit of attention to it? No. You go around and listen to some of this crap that goes on in some of these meetings, you drive you nuts. You're always talking about getting drunk or getting sober or falling off or falling in or falling out or what have you. And always worried. I listen to people, they talk, oh, I'm having an awful time to step four. I'm having all this time to step seven. When I started talking to me that, I said, how long have you been around here? Oh, 3 years, 4 years. They've never been in the steps yet, and they thought that way. Our program is divided in those four phases. Admission, submission, restitution, and construction. The first phase of our program is step one. That's it says I'm admitted that I was powerless over alcohol, and it says something else. That's all most people hear in that step. They don't hear the most important part of that step. Now, the idea that you're powerless over alcohol is a key that opens the door, that's all. But you see, that's not the most important part of that step. But people yammer and yammer and yammer about drunk, sober, month after month and year after year in some of these groups and meetings that I get into. And it's pitiful. It's too bad. I'm not criticizing people for it, but I'm just telling you how it is. What does it say up here? What's it all about? I'm trying to tell you what it's all about. I admit it. The first phase is admittance. I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. That's admitting. Second phase is submission. That's the second through seventh step. This is where we submit our will and our life without reservation to the care of God. Listen how we do this. Listen to that second step. It says, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You get two people get their backs up twice in that step. First of all, they say, power? Power? What are you talking about, power? So, who I'm referring to is God. There's a little pamphlet that some of you I gave the pamphlet to. I have a few of them left if you want to see me tomorrow. About putting your trust in a lamp. Or a desk. I've heard some of these ninnies in meetings say that they can take anything they want for their God. They can take that desk, take that light bulb, take a chair. I would hate to trust my everlasting life to a light bulb or a chair or a group or anything else. There's only one place to put your trust, and that's in God. Very simple, isn't it? Why bell around about it? Let's get down to cases and do something about it. If you can't help yourself, here's where to get help. Don't leave. You won't get your money back. It says, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. They say, I'm not nuts. Oh, you're not nuts. So we sit down and talk about some of the little details we had in our drinking career. Now, if those are the indication of something that's sane, let me know about it. You know? Nuts, we're all nuts. The greatest collection of nuts in the world right here. And if you're not nuts, as I said before, you don't belong here. All right. We came to believe that this power of my choose to cause God can restore me to sanity. Now here's the next one. It says, I made a decision. Now that's something for a rummy to do. We're the most indecisive people in the world. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. You know what the problem is in these steps, one of the big problems? And it's not your fault if you don't catch on to these real quick. Because there was a confusion set up right in the beginning between these two factions. The people in the East didn't want to emphasize God. The dummies over the Bible punchers in the Midwest laid him right out on the line. So there was quite a thing there. And when this book was being written, Bill would write some of this stuff, and Hank Parkers was helping him, he was his partner. And they'd send the chapter or so to us in Akron to edit and make comments on or add to or take away or what have you. Sometimes we'd make comments, they'd pay attention to them, sometimes they wouldn't, they'd go just on their merry way. They all just did what suited them at the time. But anyway, here, we made a decision to turn our will and lives over the care of God. Do you notice when God is mentioned in the 12 steps, in italics, it says, as we understood him. Who understood God when they arrived here? I would like the first one that ever did to stand up. I want to give him a medal. There isn't a joker in this place that understood God when he got here. And darn few of us understood too much about him after we were here a while. You know why that's in italics there? When this book was being written, a big argument ensued. This was real harmony between New York and Akron. The atheistic, agnostic-leaning people wanted to downgrade God in this book, and the Bible punchers wanted to lay him out in the line. And Hank Parkhurst, who was Bill Wilson's partner at the time, who was the two of them plot up the idea of this book, he found a printer over in New York City area. Not a publisher. We didn't have any money to pay a publisher, but he found a printer that agreed to print this book for us at a slow time in his work schedule. And he gave us a cutoff date that we should have this manuscript in there, and he printed it for us at 40 cents a copy. And so Hank and Bill, 40 cents, sell it for $3.50. They're going to get rich real quick. Alcoholic thinking. Big numbers. They're living in millions already, see? Well, the thing is, they didn't want God emphasized so strongly, and we did. The time for that book publishing, the cutoff date's fast approaching. If we don't do something, we're not going to get this book published. So as a sop and a compromise to those poor devils up in New York, we agreed to put as we understand him after we mentioned God in the steps. That's the only reason it's there. That, as I understand him, has caused more confusion in AA than anything that's ever happened. Really. Because it gives people an out. You take an alcoholic, he'll do anything but come to the point. Okay? And this gives him an out that he don't have to believe in God. He can believe in the desk or the light bulb or the group or whatever. That's God. Well, someday this poor devil is going to have to come to grips with God, either here or hereafter. And it's a good idea to do it here. It might be awful embarrassing later on. Okay? Because we're all going to have to stand before him someday. So let's cut out this nonsense of light bulbs and all that kind of crap. So, that's why you see that in that wherever God's mentioned in the 12 steps. That was a compromise, which always indicates to me it's not such a good idea to compromise. You must stand for something or fall on it, one or the other. And if we don't stand for something, we're very apt to fall for most anything. I always believe that. I'm a tough Dutchman. I got a hard head. And I can't get it in my head to water down this program in any sense at all. Now, I told you where the first AA group started. It started in Cleveland, Ohio. And I happen to be the turkey that started that group. And I'm going to tell you some things about the early days of AA if I have time. But I'd like to tell you about some people in AA that you've never heard of that were real giants in this fellowship. Now, the fourth step says I made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. There's a step that 99 out of 100 people who come to my house know nothing about. They have no understanding of that step at all. And I'll tell you why. Most of the people, especially girls that come, when a girl comes, I know what to expect. This gal will come with a sheaf of papers this thick that she's written all the crud that she's ever engaged in all her life. And she thinks that's her inventory, her fourth step. That isn't what I'm looking for. That isn't what the program is looking for. I'm not interested in all her bed scrap hopping and all the crap that she got into. We're all alcoholics. We've done a lot of things that wouldn't look good in print. Any of us. I don't care who we are. That's not what that step calls for. It says, I made a searching and fearless moral inventory. What is that? It is simply this. It's what moral problems, weaknesses we have caused us to become alcoholic. I have 20 questions that I ask a person in the fourth step. I have them written on a piece of paper, and I ask them about these different things that are moral weaknesses. First of all, I ask them about self-pity. Do you indulge in self-pity? Well, maybe he does, maybe he don't. Self-justification, self-importance, self-condemnation, dishonesty, impatience, hate, resentments, false pride, jealousy, enviousness, laziness, procrastination, insincerity, negative thinking, vulgar immoral thinking, criticizing, gossiping. I ask people, do they have these? I ask them one by one of these things. They tell me whether they have or not. There are 20 things, 20 questions that have to do with make us what we are. Usually people have 10 or 12 of these weaknesses. That's about it. I've only met one person, one man, that had all 20 of them. I met one gal when they had 19. She was a real honey. She came over from South Carolina, so you can understand. But anyway, here's what we're looking for in step four. What are these characteristics that need taken care of and getting rid of? So we admitted that we are powerless and our life's unmanageable in the first step. So we can't do a bloody thing about those things. They are part of us. We've been living with them. They're the ones that drove us into this group, drove us into alcoholism and eventually got us here because we had all those defects of character. If we were perfect people, we wouldn't be here. If we didn't have all those defects, we wouldn't be here. See? So this is what brought us here. Now, what about it? So we make a searching and peerless moral inventory of ourselves. So the next step, what does it say in the next step? It says, admit it to God. Now they finally got around to talking about God without any ifs, ands, and buts. Admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Not the wrongs themselves, the nature of our wrongs. Those are those 20 questions I'm talking about. That's it. See? Once we find out what the nature of our wrongs is, then we find out a way to get rid of that kind of crap. And we're unable to do it ourselves. We admit that right off the bat. We admit to God, ourselves, and other human beings the exact nature of our wrongs. Now what does it say? We admitted right off the place we can't help ourselves, so we hired a manager in step three. If our life's unmanageable, we have to hire a manager. So step three is where we hire a manager. Step three says, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That's my new manager. He'll help. I can't do these things myself, but between he and I, we can do anything. See? So I have to depend on him. So we get down here. I'm entirely ready. Did you get that word? Entirely. Rummies are entirely in everything they do. We're entirely when we do something decent, we're entirely when we screw up. We never know halfway measure with a rummy. We're extremists. So we're entirely ready for what? Now get this. To have God remove all these defects of character. Isn't that simple? Did you ever hear it before? You read it. Did you ever get through? There's a way to work it. So we're entirely ready to have God remove it. Now what do we do about it? Since we hired him as a manager, we expect him to help us, because we can't help ourselves. So step seven says we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. We humbly ask him to remove them because we can't do it. See? But when I take a person through the steps, he's on his knees in step three, and he's on his knees in step seven. See? He asks that new manager. He never forgets it. That's why people go home and have a good life and don't drink or worry about it anymore. There's only one way to do this program. A lot of people disagree with that. I hear people talk about my program, your program. I say, hell, there's only one program. And we're talking about it right now. After seven steps, that's the first day, we finished our first day, I gave this person some papers, several sheets of paper and send them to his room and tell him to write down a list of people he has to make restitution to. Make a list of all persons we'd harmed and be willing to make amends to them all. So I tell him who those people are. Tell him you start with your family, your mother, father, sister, brother, aunts, uncles, cousins, your kids, your so on and so on. Grandma, grandpa, the people you worked with, the people you cheated, the people you robbed, the people you double-timed with, anybody you owe apologies to. And bring those sheets to me in the morning. And they bring them out to me in the morning. I look at them and I tell them what to do in every instance. Every one of those things. I tell them what to do. If you don't, they won't do it. You gotta tell them it's urgent. It has to be done now. Now. So, they made a list of all persons we'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Obviously, you cannot make amends to everyone you've harmed. You don't know everyone you've harmed. And some that you do know are out of your orbit. They're either dead or they moved away. You don't know where they are. So, but the ones you can contact by phone, letter, or in person, you do that. The ones you cannot contact, you leave that to your new manager. He'll take care of that for you if you ask him. Anything you ask him, believing he'll do it, he'll do it. So you've got to believe he'll do it. And he'll do it. He'll do it. So, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I don't think anyone ought to go through that restitution by himself. He should go through that with another person, his sponsor, or a person who knows how to handle things like this. Because we need guidance, we need support, and we need advice. We can hurt a lot of people by trying to get our skirts clean at the expense of somebody else. So there's things that we just don't talk about to other people. You talk to your sponsor or whoever your spiritual advisor might be. Preferably a good, knowledgeable sponsor. So, we made direct amends to such people and so forth. After 9 steps, forget them. Forget them. You've done them. You don't eat your breakfast twice, either once. You take the steps once, and your life changes. You're a different person. If you take these steps, you're going to find out you're going to talk differently. You're going to look at people differently. Your language is going to be different. You're going to address people differently. You're going to have different respect for yourself and for other people. And you'll finally go through these steps. After 9 steps, you are a different person. You're not the same guy or gal anymore. You're under new management. You've hired a manager. You're under new management. This is what so many people miss in this program. And it's so simple. It's like the nose on your face right in front of you all the time. And somebody cons us off of it. They say, easy does it. Easy does it? Yeah. But do it. That's very important. No, you just don't lay down. It takes some gumption. It takes some attention. It takes some honesty and some, you know, we didn't have all this stuff when I started out. I was in on the writing of this stuff. I know what it's all meant for. But we had that 6-step program, which is the same as this, and they called the Oxford Movement a life-changing program. You want to get your life changed, life in order, you join the Oxford Group. That Oxford Movement became a worldwide movement. It was a powerful movement. But the human element got in there, and they start changing things. And cutting corners, and conniving, and so forth, and dishonesty in one thing or another. And I remember when they changed the name of the Oxford Movement to Moral Rearmament. Frank Buckman, who started the whole thing, he was a very conscientious guy, and he figured that anyone could change his life through these 6 steps of the Oxford Movement with the 4 absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. And he went out and he converted a lot of people into this way of thinking. He went out and got unions to working with management. He accomplished a lot of things. He got some very important people in the world in this fellowship. It's got to be a powerful thing. But here's what happened to this thing. And this is something you don't read about much. Maybe some of you have. But the war came along. Hitler came along. And Frank Buckman was sincere in what he was doing, but he was misunderstood. And he said that he thought that Hitler could be changed with this program. And he believed that. And a lot of people just listen to part of things that are said, or they interpret it in some cockeyed way, such as they do in AA. And they had an idea that he was a pro-Hitler guy, and he wasn't at all. But that caused an awful rumpus in moral rearmament, believe me. But that's a sad thing that happened. But it did. Well, anyway, that's all behind it. Now, after we've done 9 steps, forget them. So it says in the 10th step, it's another inventory step, and it has absolutely nothing to do with step 4. You take step 4 once. Step 10 is different. It says we continue to take personal inventory. The other step says we took a moral inventory. This is entirely different. Continue to take personal inventory, and it says something else. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Boy, ain't that something for Rummy to do? We never admit anything. That's the first law of Rummy. Don't admit anything. Don't give your right name. Yes. I don't suppose any of you people ever been in court. But if you haven't, go down to court some. A Monday morning is a good time to go. They pick up these drunks over the weekend and throw them in the slammer to sober up, and then the Monday morning they come before the judge or magistrate or whatever you have here, and somebody reads off the charges against this turkey. He's been out and all wound up, and he took his car. He went through a store window, sideswiped the police car, got out and fought the police, and everything happened, and they throw him in a jug. So Monday morning he comes up, and they read all the charges to him. The judge says, "You were drunk." "No. No, 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 no." "Well, you were drinking." "Nah." Finally, after a lot of wheeling, this monkey will break down and admit that he had a couple of beers. I have never heard of anybody getting in trouble drinking whiskey. But those guys that have a couple of beers are a disaster. Okay? Boy. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, not admit it. We never admit anything if we could help it. Don't admit anything. That's the first law of a rummy. But here we're promptly admitting when we're wrong. See, you know, that's a great thing. That 10th step is very important, and here's how I do mine. After you've done your 9 steps, you forget them. You live on the last 3 steps. Remember that. Don't ever forget it. Forget those other 9 after you've done them. So here's how I do mine. I have to have simple things. I'm not complicated enough to take these complicated programs that somebody's invented. At night, my day is over with. I'm in bed. The lights are out. And it's my prayer time. Grace has her prayer time. She has a lot longer than mine. She's a bigger sinner than I am. But she goes at it in great shape. And she does a lot of praying for me. And I'm glad I have her. But anyway, I need it. But at night, I'm lying in bed, and I have my prayer time. And I think about my day. Here's how I do my personal inventory. I think about where I've been today, what I do, what transpired. Who did I meet? It's amazing how many things happen to a person in one day's time. Really, it is. You do this tonight when you get home. I figure, have I done any good today? If I have, I give myself a pat on the back. I say, "Oh boy, you get a star for that one." On the other hand, maybe I've hurt you, and I owe you an apology. My first priority tomorrow morning is to come and straighten that thing up, make my apology. It says we promptly admitted it. It didn't say at our leisure. We're the greatest people in the world for procrastination. And if we don't do it promptly, it gets very easy to let that slide. And another thing flies, and another thing flies. First thing you know, you got a pile over here that you can't get over. So do it promptly. Keep the life clean day by day. They talk about a day at a time in AA. You ask 9 out of 10 monkeys in an AA meeting what that means, a day at a time. You know what they'll tell you? "I'm going to stay sober a day at a time." "Well, you idiot, you are sober." Thank God for it. You don't have to be sober. You are sober. You don't come here to get sober. You come here to learn how to live. Don't ever forget that. So here it is. We take the personal inventory. When we're wrong, we promptly admitted it. Get that behind us. Then we don't have to duck these people that we owe apologies to. We can meet everybody on the open, on the up and up. It's a great step. 11th step, listen to this one. There's a lot of words in this step, but it's really something. It says we're seeking something. I sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. Now let's break that down so we know what we're doing here. I'm seeking something. The good book tells me, seek and ye shall find. That Jesus said that. Seek and ye shall find. I'm seeking something through prayer and meditation. Now what is prayer and what is meditation? To me, prayer is talking to my new manager and meditation is listening to him. Did it ever occur to you that the good Lord gave you two ears and one mouth? There must be a reason for that. Are we going to talk or are we going to listen? I'm seeking through talking to my new manager and listening to him to improve my conscious contact with God, it says. Now, what does that mean, if anything? That means this, that he is not way out here beyond the clouds, high out in the blue yonder. He's right here, as close to me as the law here. I can talk to him. I can listen to him. I can converse with him. I can get answers from him. He's not inaccessible. He's everywhere. Remember when those fellows landed on the moon? Remember they talked to him up there while you and I are talking to him down here. You know, that's quite some deal. So any place we go, he's there. He never ran away from us. We moved away from him. He's there all the time. And he wants to help us. He wants to be in part. He's our boss. We hired him. Let's use him. Okay. So I sought through talking to him and listening to him to improve my conscious contact. Now it tells me what I'm praying for. You ask a lot of people in AA meeting who they pray for, what they pray for. I pray to be sober. Oh, yeah, idiot, you are sober. Thank him for it. You've got other things to pray about. You're supposed to pray for knowledge of his will. I've turned my will and life over to you, boss. Now send me. Tell me what you want me to do and give me the strength to do it. That's all that stuff says. According to the good book, tells me that he'll never put anything on me, that he won't give me the power to execute. See? That's a tremendous step. I mean, get there and break it down, find out what's in it. I sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with my new manager, praying only for knowledge of his will. It's your will, not mine. What's your will? What do you want me to do? I'm your boy. You send me and I'll go. I think about these things. When Doc told me to go back to Cleveland, spend the rest of my life fixing drunks, that's what I was trying to do. I didn't understand it all at that time. Eventually it came through to me. Now the last step says something. Listen to what it says, this last step. Having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, not because you come to meetings, they're great. I wonder if we should have meetings. We should have parties. We should have picnics. We should have fellowship. But that ain't what this says. Having had a spiritual experience, and what is that, pray tell? That's that change. Not here. You hear these monkeys, you come in and they say, change your thinking. What thinking? If you could think, you wouldn't come here. Not the thinking you change, it's 14 inches below the thinking down here. Having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, I went through these steps and I had a spiritual experience. What's that? That's that change. I'm a different person. I tried to carry this message. Not the alcoholic, I carry the message to other alcoholics. And I practice these principles in all of my affairs. What principles? The principles of love and service. That's very simple. So that's what we do. We go out and do this. And you and I are qualified to do this. Other people aren't. If we're not the ones to do the job, then the job's not going to be done. You know, this is a wonderful program. It's good for anybody. Everybody's getting on the bandwagon now. We've got Gamblers Anonymous. We've got Fatos Anonymous. We've got Skinny Anonymous. We've got Dopes Anonymous. We've got all kinds of anonymouses. But remember one thing, kids. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what it says on a book. And this program, this fellowship of ours, is for alcoholics and their families. That's it. There are facilities for these other people. I don't say that we can't lend them a hand, but they don't belong here. They don't belong here unless they're fundamentally alcoholics in their families. I know for years the wife or husband of an alcoholic and the family of an alcoholic always was at the meetings. We didn't have any second-class citizens in Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't have Al-Anon or any of that kind of thing. This is a family illness, and the whole family is sick. And I want to say this. I've seen most cases where the non-alcoholic is sicker than the rummy. And they have a good reason to be sicker than the rummy. They get sick of us, of my mercy. No, the rummy, what happens? You go down the pathway of life with an alcoholic, and boy, you have to make the excuses, tell the lies, and call the boss and lie to him, and have to fight with the collectors, and take care of everything, see the kids have shoes, and have milk in the house, and bread on the table, and this monkey's out there drunk. See? No wonder they're crazier than we are. What happens when things get tough with a rummy? What does he do? He jumps in the jug and gets anesthetized. He don't feel anything. But the non-alcoholic has taken all the crap. So she's bound, he or she's bound to be crazier than we are. Because they've had to face up to this stuff, and we didn't. Ever think of that? I think that all alcoholics and their families should be at meetings. We had a wonderful fellowship years ago. Wonderful. I don't think that we can revert to what we once had because we're in different times, in different time frame entirely. But the principles of this program are the same. We come here to learn how to live and to live as human beings are intended to live. And we learn how to live and we learn how to serve. And you and I have the greatest of opportunities of serving and doing something that other people can't do. How long have I got here? 2 hours, he said. I still lie. I wish I had had time to tell you about some of the people. Let me tell you a few things about the beginning of AA in Cleveland, Ohio. I'm a guy. I noticed today so many people have a fetish about anonymity, and that's the biggest bunch of hogwash I ever heard. Here a guy lies around drunk for 15, 20 years or so, and police have been taking him out, and he's been abusing the family. He's had 2 or 3 DWIs, losing a job here and there, lying out in the gutter. Everybody knows he's a drunk. He comes into AA and gets straightened out. Ooh, don't tell anybody I'm in AA. Don't tell anybody I'm well. Isn't this ridiculous? You're supposed to tell people. So I got in a lot of trouble, and I still do. I don't mind telling you, I get in trouble with a lot of people. That's their problem, it ain't mine. But years ago, I got a lot of publicity for this fellowship. The first publicity, real stuff, that I found a drunken newspaper reporter who his wife had committed him to a funny farm and threw the key away on him. And he'd been kicked off of nearly every newspaper in Northern Ohio for being drunk. And a little guy who I used to call on all these social places and talk about drunks. This little guy, Jerry Halley, a little Jewish insurance man, called me one day and told me about this fellow, Larry Jewell. And Larry was a newspaper man, as I said, and he was out in this funny farm. And he thought that Elrick Davis is the name, excuse me. He said that Elrick should be fixed. He's a good man. So we went out and talked to Elrick, and I had the AA book under my arm. And of course, being on that funny farm, he'd do anything to get out of that coop. So we talked to him about reading this book, and maybe he could write some articles or something, and maybe he could get started again in the reporting business, newspaper business. Well, he was all for it. He'll do anything to get out of that joint. So we went out to see his wife and sold her the idea of letting the guy out again, and she did. So he wrote a series of articles in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which I imagine a lot of you have read at different times. And my heavens, you never in your life would believe the inquiries that come in. Not just around Cleveland, they came from all over the country. And somebody would cut these articles out and send them out to Uncle Slug out here in Wyoming somewhere. And they would write in. And we start getting inquiries. Now remember, we didn't have all that many guys around Cleveland. And the inquiries all came to me. About a week or so after the Plain Dealer articles, a preacher there, whom my wife Dorothy had sicked onto me several years before, and he tried everything. I sure got to give that guy an E for effort. I made life miserable for that poor guy. But he stuck with it, and I thought I owed him something. So after I was sober a year, I went in to see him. If I tell you all the things that happened between him and me, you wouldn't believe it, so I'm not going to tell you to take too much time. But believe me, this guy had patience. So I went back to see him when I'm sober a year, and you know, I walked into his office and he didn't know me. He'd never seen me sober. He'd never seen me cleaned up with a suit and all that sort of thing. And I had some meat on me by that time. And finally he realized who I was, and he couldn't contain himself. So he, another Sunday or so later, he preached a sermon about Mr. X and Alcoholics Anonymous. I was Mr. X. He took my story. And he published that story in pamphlet form. That's the first pamphlet we ever had. In the meantime, all these Plain Dealer articles came in, and another newspaper man wrote a series of articles on the history of alcoholism dating back to the Dark Ages. We got an awful lot of publicity. Every day I would get a big handful of these inquiries from around out of town and in town. And the men I had there, they were dry. I'd give every man on Monday morning a handful of these inquiries and tell them to run them down and report to me Wednesday what he did with them, just like a sales manager does. And these guys did it. They all were anxious to do this. Man, did we grow, you know. I remember looking at that group, first group we had in Cleveland one night, and I said to myself, gee, if we ever had as many as 35 members here, wouldn't we have some group? It wasn't 2 years' time, we had 35 groups. See, this is what happened. Everybody was out there punching, and we were growing. Bill Wilson and that bunch from up in New York came down to see what we were doing. They weren't getting any place. We were filling seats all the time. I have to tell you something that happened then. There was no way possible that we could sit down one-on-one and sponsor these people that were coming in so fast. And I'm trying to figure out some way we can hold classes and teach AA in classes. We don't have any money to rent halls, and so I figure we got to do something, so I'm praying about this. So one day I'm out chasing up some of these inquiries, and I have a guy's name, Walter Beilstein. And old Walter, I went out, he was living in a neighborhood that was declining. And it used to be Millionaire's Neighborhood, where they had those big 24-room houses with the carriage house in the back, and all those people had moved out to the Heights, and most of those houses were now rooming houses or something of that order. And but I got out there, and Walter Beilstein, I see it's a Beilstein funeral home. They'd taken this big house and made a funeral parlor out of it. So I charge up into the funeral parlor and ask for Walter Beilstein. The guy says, who? I says, Walter Beilstein. He says, oh, Walter. Now I know I'm in the right place. He says he's not here. He lives up over the carriage house in the back. You'll find him up there. So I hike back there and go up the steps and pound on the door. And here comes to the door this apparition, Walter. He's a young fellow in his early 30s. He's wearing a beret. In those days, guys wearing berets were looked upon with some suspicion. So Walter is very affable, he's very polite, and he's very drunk. And he invites me in his house. So I go in with Walter, and I look at that place, and it's almost as long as this hall here, almost. And I thought, holy smokes, here is my answer to my prayers. Walter had two hobbies. He had a Great Dane dog that weighed 165 pounds, and he thought it was a chihuahua. He liked to play and jump on you. A 165-pound dog jumping at you. He's just playful. He didn't mean anything. He'd knock you on your tan anyway. And that was his love. And Walter's hobby was amateur theatricals. He used to put on shows up there. He'd gotten a hold of a couple hundred picture show seats that some show went out of business. He had them stapled to the floor. And on one end, he had a stage up here with all the props and the drops and everything. On the other end was where he slept, and he had his kitchen and his bathroom and the whole thing on the other end. I looked at that thing, and I said, Walter, you are a gift from heaven.
He says, I am.
I said, yes, you are. I said, how many seats do you have there? He says, about 200. Now, I know he's a ham. So I said, Walter, you know what? He says, what? We're going to fill those seats every night. That's all he wanted to hear. He wants those seats filled up. He didn't know for what. So I made Walter a captain in AA. He got a battlefield commission. The first and only captain we ever had. Everybody ever always called Walter captain. Walter had never had any association with females for some reason or other. And it just didn't seem to be his bag. And so Walter got so busy running around, chasing around these different hospitals and different places and AA and all over Cleveland that he forgot to get drunk. And he got so busy, and Walter went and got himself, you know, he got to one of our hospitals, and he met a nurse in his hospital. And something happened to Walter that never happened before. Walter got an itch that he couldn't scratch. And he takes after this nurse, and he starts courting her. And the next thing you know, he wants to marry her. Well, this girl agreed that she would marry him, but there was a condition. He'd have to get rid of that dog. There's too much dog for one house. 165 pounds is like having a horse in a house. So he'd have to dispense with the dog. Well, this gave Walter his first real big problem in life. That pal is, that dog was his life, you know, up to this time. So love will prevail. So Walter gave his dog to somebody out in the country, and this pair got married. Well, Walter's very busy. For some time, he's running around AA and all over, of course, as usual. And finally, I see Walter is slowing up, and he isn't looking so good. So I went to Walter and said, Walter, something is wrong with you. You're not the same old bubbly self as you were. Tell Papa what's wrong. He says, I miss my dog. I said, well, I suppose you do, but you made a deal with Mary and that's it. He says, well, I still want my dog. I says, well, maybe you might talk to her and get some weekend visiting privileges or something. I didn't think she would, but any old port in a storm. So he consulted her on that, and she was adamant. No, no dope. No, no go. So he had another big problem then, and he has to make another choice, either the dog or his wife. So he threw her out and got the dog back. I tell you, I could keep you going crazy on some of these people that are around in those days, and they're all true stories, too. But some of them are so miraculous. I want to tell you about one...
What is that, Frank? One more.
You're going to let me tell about one miracle. What's the matter with these guys that wear beards? Something wrong with guys with whiskers. They're hiding something. Well, I'm living in a cheap boarding house. I'm paying $20 a week, room and board. I get 2 meals a day and one on Sunday, which means I have to buy other meals out of my $20. But the $10 is left, so I'm not real flush. I'm the last of the great spenders, see? Well, anyway, I noticed one day some fella come charging in this boarding house, and boy, he's all dolled up like Mrs. Astor's pet horse. He has a cart shaft and marked suit on, another one over his shoulder, and beautiful luggage, nice wavy hair, handsome guy. And I look at this guy, what's he doing in this dump? You know, boarding house. And so I'm busy, and I leave it go. So it goes several days, and every day I see him, he still has the same shirt, same suit, hasn't shaved, and he's starting to smell. And he smells more every day, and he gets drunkier every day. So finally one day, the whole thing came with him. I was going with a girl then, and I wanted to have her come over and meet these birds that I was living with, you know. All kinds of people, about 35 people living in that house I was in. Some of them were alcoholics. So I was going to be the genial host. It cost me 50 cents to have her over for dinner. Old lady Mac that run the joint, if we hadn't started any fires in our room or anything, and we behaved ourselves reasonably well, she would let us bring a guest once in a while for 50 cents for dinner. So I asked this girl for dinner, and she came over. And we're sitting there, and I'm the genial host, introducing her to these nitwits around there. And finally, I look up, and the doorway is right opposite where we're sitting. Here stands that apparition. This guy's name was Willis Kilgore, the handsome guy. And boy, he's so drunk, he don't know if he's in Cleveland or Venezuela. And he is dirty, and he is drunk, and he still has the same suit on and same tie and shirt that he had when he came in a week ago. The only difference is they're dirtier and smellier. And what does he do? He comes right in and plunks himself down in a chair in front of this gal of mine and myself. Well, I hit the ceiling. I got a 50-cent investment in this date, don't you? And I start to yowl. And this girl said, Clarence, you got to fix him. I said, I'll fix him. I'll kill him. No, you got to do it. So that's the end of that evening. So I took him upstairs to find out who he was. He's tapped out by then. Came from Atlanta. He was a salesman. His folks owned a big lumber company and a toy factory up there, and he was a salesman. His job was to go around to different department stores and sell these toys. He'd been up, now listen to this for a miracle. If you can tie this, I want to hear it. He'd been in Detroit at the Book Cadillac Hotel, and of course he'd had some experiences up there before, being a periodic drunk. And the assistant manager of the hotel said to him, Willis, he says, there's some fellas in Cleveland, I don't know where they are in Cleveland, but they're in Cleveland, that have some way of fixing drunks. You ought to go down and meet those people. And Willis don't know anything about who we are, where we are, or what we are. Nothing. He gets on a train and comes from Detroit to Cleveland, gets off in the terminal down and gets on a Euclid Avenue streetcar, and got off the streetcar right in front of that cheap boarding house where I live, along with 7 or 8 other rummies. And he walks in there. I've talked to Willis time and again about it. He can't understand how he ever did it. I can't understand. Will you tell me what that is? So I found out he's from Atlanta. I called his mother, Collect, and told her she'd send me $50. I'd put him in a dry out place and clean him up and fix him. So she wired me the dough. I put old Willis out in Post Shaker Sanitarium, and he never had a drink to his dying day. He's the guy that started the Atlanta, Georgia group. See? I could tell you a dozen stories of such miraculous things like this. Don't tell me that I was this smart. This is all God-directed situations in the word go. And I just wish I had more time to tell you about some of these people, because these stories are unbelievable. Unless you've been there, it's hard for anybody to believe it, really. But I knew all these people. I sponsored the first woman in AA, who Bill and Doc were against female alcoholics. Thumbs down. They're afraid they would probably corrupt the men. And female alcoholics weren't as apparent then as they are today. They were mostly closet drinkers, unless they were prostitutes or something off in the streets. But most of the women drank in their homes and didn't get out and wandering around like they do today. But they were against it. And I sponsored the first gal, Sylvia Kaufman. She came clear from Chicago. I had a sister who was a nurse in Chicago in a hospital, and she told that girl to come see me. She came to Cleveland, got fixed, went back, got a whole world treat, and they started the Chicago group. The first woman. Don't you think I didn't catch hell for bringing women in AA? I brought a number of men. Finally, there's more of them coming in now than there are men, I think. I can't go on anymore. This whiskered gentleman won't let me talk anymore. So I'm going to have to button it up. But I would like sometime, maybe we can get together again, and I'll tell you about some real people that it's going to warm your heart to hear about them, really, because they were there, they did it. This didn't start in New York. This was not spread from there at all. Those people came to Cleveland and went out and out and out. And that's how this AA got underway. And people who did this without any thought of a dollar return. They did this out of labor of love. And that's what this is. I'm an amateur, and I intend to stay that way the rest of my life. I could have made a lot of money in AA. I had the opportunities. I wouldn't take a quarter for fixing anybody. I still operate that way. I've been doing that for 40-some years, 45 years and better. And I'll continue to do that if I live another 45. It's awful nice talking to you. You've been a great bunch of people, and I hope I see you all again. I'm certainly glad to see some of my old friends I've seen before up here. It's been a great I'm really grateful that you came over to visit with us. And until the next time, God bless all of you.